I'm going to discuss a presentation or an assessment that we did in the city of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County, which is located in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. First, I want to talk about the Healthy Community Council. We are a community-based organization composed of at least 70 community members, maybe up to 100. We have individuals from the Department of Health, Department of Social Services, the local hospital, the local sheriff's office. We have four universities within, I would guess, a 10 to 15-mile radius, and so we have representatives from the local universities as well, school system. One of the mission of the Healthy Community Council has been to enhance the quality of life for the community through both collaborative efforts of individuals, agencies, and institutions. Our vision has been to assess community needs, identify areas of priority, help plan and coordinate initiatives around those priority areas that we're going to talk about today, and then evaluate them. Overview, we actually started this process in the spring of 2005. And I mentioned in looking at the vision, we have been doing assessments, or that's been one of our visions, and we have done it in 1996, 2001, and again in 2006. We don't have a lot of longitudinal data as far as comparing, 1996 to 2001 to 2006, because we made radical changes to the assessment instrument. We established in the spring of 2005 the goals and objectives of what we wanted to accomplish with doing the assessment in the 2006 process. And I actually have handouts, the green ones here. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned. And we gathered and reviewed community assessments across the country. There was two that really emerged as model assessments, and that was in Jacksonville, Florida, and Marin County, California. And from that, we also started to review the 2001 Healthy Community Council assessment to kind of see what things do we want to retain as far as things to measure, instrument items, where we wanted to go with the methodology of it, what did we do well, what could we have done a little bit better. And one thing that did emerge was that we wanted to have an integrated process. And then 2001 assessment, they had two assessment instruments for the English-speaking population, one for individuals under the age of 64 and under, and one for the individuals of 65 and older. This time, for this 2006 assessment, we did have an integrated process, just one instrument for the English-speaking population. And getting started, again, this started back in, again, spring of 2005, so it's taken us 1.5 to 2 years to actually complete the process. We developed assessment categories and indicators, and we spent probably 6 months just working on what do we want to measure and how do we want to measure it, and getting community feedback throughout the process. We ended up with 7 categories to measure quality of life and probably had a total of 40 to 50 indicators. We started off with about nearly 400 indicators in the beginning and trying to figure out. We all wanted to measure everything. And then we started to have to ask some very serious questions about how are we going to use this data and who's going to use this data. And I'll talk about that towards the end. We obtained feedback on the indicators at a Healthy Community Council quarterly meeting. The big council of 70 to 100 individuals meets quarterly, and so we came prepared with the indicators we wanted to measure and got their feedback on, were we in the right place, should we do something different, because in the past, and we hope with the 2006 assessment data, we have brought in nearly $11 million to the community from using the 2001 assessment data, and we're hoping the same will happen, actually bring in more money from using the 2006 data. So we wanted their feedback. How are they going to use it? What did they need? What did they want us to assess? We identified indicators either as survey items, things that we were going to ask on the assessment instrument, or whether or not it was existing data item. Like one thing was teen pregnancy. We didn't need to ask that, obviously, on an assessment instrument. We generated the assessment survey items. We tried, again, to look at other assessments, and particularly the National Health Interview Survey is a really well-designed instrument for assessing a lot of the health questions. But as I stated early on, this was a quality of life assessment, and we did more than health. We generated the assessment survey items. We pilot tested the assessment instrument with community members that mimicked our overall participants that we intended to send the assessment to. And these are the 7 categories that emerged: economic vitality, community infrastructure, environmental quality, health and wellness, which I'm going to talk a little bit about today, is the mental health component of the health and wellness, the social welfare, education, and youth. And again, with each of these, we had anywhere from 5 to 10 indicators for each of them. I have, and I'm just going to show it to you later on, this is the actual report. Mine looks pretty bad because I carry it everywhere, like I sleep with it, which is kind of sad. It's like my dissertation. And in there, it has a table of contents which lists a lot of the indicators under each of the categories. And all of this is on our web, and I have the website, which is in your handout, and on the last slide of the presentation. But just talking about the methodology, we did obtain Institutional Review Board approval from the institution that I teach at, James Madison University. I bribed my health science students who are epidemiology students, where they're taking an epidemiology class and made environmental health class, to actually help us recruit participants. What we did was developed a telephone script. We tested it with a few individuals, piloted. Then we had students come for 3 nights, and we fed them pizza, went over what we wanted them to do, and then from 6 to 9, they actually called participants. We had purchased 3,000 names, which I think is on the next slide, from Survey Sampling International, and had the students call and ask for their participation in the survey. If they agreed to participate, we mailed them a survey with a consent form. We didn't want signatures, so it was more of just by doing this survey, you consent. We had a self-addressed stamped envelope. We asked them to send it back. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more in a minute. But we did have two methods for this assessment. One was, again, the English-speaking population and then the Latino population, two different methodologies for capturing needs assessments among those populations, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Again, in the sampling, which I already mentioned, we purchased about 3,000 names as random sample based on zip code. We stratified using random sampling techniques. Again, the city has about 40-some thousand individuals living in there. If you look at the census data, the county has 80-some thousand. And so the county is pretty large, and so we split that up into 4 discrete areas and sampled based on zip code. We sent out a total of 1,645 packets, 684 of those returned. We had a response rate of 42%, which, if you know anything about survey research, you usually anticipate about 20% response rate, a sampling error of 3.8% if you use Don Dillman's method. While we think we got a high response rate is if you look at what Dillman recommends, if you do call individuals and ask for their participation, explain to them the assessment, the purpose for doing it, you tend to get a higher response rate. So it does take up a little time, but again, students are cheap and you can, you know, extra credit goes a long way. And so we actually, someone asked me after my last presentation at 8:30 this morning about this a little bit more, so I'll go in a little bit more depth if I have time. What we did was the 1,645, we actually had 900 and some people, and I don't remember, I'm doing another presentation tomorrow, it was 968 or something, who said, yes, we will participate. We called them, we actually got a yes. Of that, nearly 600 of them returned it, so we had about a 58% response rate, that I remember, from people who we actually called, the student talked to them, and they said yes. Where it went lower was that we had 700 and some left over, where we tried to contact them twice via phone. We either left a message or we didn't get an answer. If they said no, we crossed them off. We didn't stalk anyone. But if we couldn't get a response after 2 tries, we went ahead and just sent out, because we had the addresses, to individuals. And of that 700 and some, we could not reach after 2 attempts. We had about 138 come back to us, which was a 19% response rate if you divide those two numbers. So, which goes with Don Dillman's about 20% if you don't call them. So it helped out a little bit to send them. The data analysis we put into SPSS, we actually scanned. We had the instrument nicely printed. We had someone do a program so that we could scan in the instrument so we didn't have to hand enter them to reduce error. We conducted descriptive analysis of frequencies and cross-tabulations, disseminated the data to what we call action team members. These are individuals, again, community individuals who provide care, who are experts in, say, mental health, experts in education, those kind of things. And so in those categories, we sent back the data to them and said, this is the area you work in. This is, you serve individuals in this capacity. Can you provide us, help us with analysis, not the analysis, but the interpretation and the write-up. And so a lot of people actually contributed to the writing of this document and the development of tables and graphs, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We hired a technical writer and actually had her kind of, again, this was a group process, help us all have basically one voice to make the report kind of flow, and she provided that with us to make sure that we were all kind of using the same graphics and that stuff. Even though you have 7 to 10 people working on one document, you want it to have some kind of flow, and she did an excellent job. Now the second wave was the Latino assessment. This morning I had a little bit of confusion with this too. We purchased 1,000 surnames. Individuals, if you call survey sampling and ask, we want to reach this population, they can provide surnames where can give you a pretty good idea of the population you want to survey. We had conducted a little bit different the methodology. We did the assessment via telephone, and we did a modified version of the English speaking assessment because it had 52 items on the English speaking assessment. We modified it to, I think, have 25 or so for the Hispanic survey or Latino survey. We entered the data. They actually, again, asked the questions. We had a telephone script for them. They got the responses. We had 266 actually complete the survey. About 18% of those 1,000 names, however, was disconnected or... The demographics of the adult English-speaking population, this is 64 and younger. We did divide it up, did cross tabs for that. If you notice, 45 to 64-year-olds was composed about 46% of the sample. 46% were male, 78% were married, 11% had incomes below $25,000, and 17% had incomes between $35,000 and $50,000. The demographics of the senior or 65-plus English-speaking population, we had nearly 30% of survey participants were in this age bracket, which was a concern in the beginning when we started this in the spring of 2005. There was concern that we would not reach this population. There were several people around the table that were concerned because they were providing services to this population, and that we know that it's a growing population, not just in our community, but nationwide, worldwide. And so we wanted to make sure that we were assessing their needs, as we will be providing more needs for this population. 41% of those who completed it were male, 59% were married, 36% lived alone, and their incomes, you can see, 16% were under $15,000 and 17% were between $15,000 and $25,000. The demographics of the Latino population, one thing that just kind of just jumps out is that we only had 2% of the sample. Again, it was 266 individuals over 65. If you look at the demographics and look at the census, it mimics very much the census for our community. Have a relatively young Latino population. 59% were married, 38% were male. Incomes were quite a bit of 70% were under $25,000. And then again, this is looking at the mental health component of the health and well-being assessment category. Depression is one thing that we're concerned about, and we did not do a good job. We just skimmed the surface, I guess I should say, in the 2001 assessment on mental health. Adults, 11.3%, we asked a question in the last, it's a national health interview survey type of question, in the last 30 days, have you experienced any kind of psychological stress of any type, and that would include depression. 11.3% in 2006 compared to 6.6% in 2001. If you look at the National Health Interview Survey, their data from 2006 had 2.9%. Seniors, 3% compared to 4.4% in 2001, and the and that's the National Health Interview Survey, 2.3%. Latinos, nearly 25% compared to 17% in 2001. So that's an area that I'll discuss a little bit later. Treatment for psychological distress, we asked, are you getting treatment if you are having, indeed, psychological distress? 15% of adults said yes, 14% of seniors. We did not assess this in the Latino. Counseling, 12% of adults and 5% of seniors. Again, we know this is descriptive statistics, but we're looking at what services do we need to provide in our community and to what degree do we need to provide to what target population. Substance abuse. We did not assess drug usage. We did assess alcohol consumption, both acute drinking. We looked at 19% of adults stated yes, and seniors was 5%. And this was, we were very specific about what acute drinking was defined as, and it's 4 or more for females or 5 or more for males drinks per day. alcohol consumption, and this is a little misleading. This is where I think we need to reword this question. This is what we did with the 2001 assessment. Okay, what questions do we need to reword for the 2006? And we're doing that now for the 2011 assessment. And this one, and I would fall in this category after doing this assessment, but we asked how many have you had a drink in the last month? And it did increase. It was 57% for adults, and then seniors were 32, up from 11%. It basically said if you had a drink in the, I think, the last 30 days. I'll have to look it up, but it was very vague. It wasn't, when we went back and looked at the data, we're like, why did we ask this question? So, because we all felt like we even fell into that even more after doing the assessment. Assistance with substance abuse, assistance alcohol, we actually asked, if you have an alcohol issue, are you seeking service? And 2% of adults said yes, and 1% of seniors. Assistance with drug abuse, we did ask this question but didn't ask about the drugs, so that was another limitation, but 2% of adults said yes, and 0% of seniors. We asked a question which I thought was kind of interesting. Has alcohol ever had an effect on you or your family? Didn't ask if you were involved in the alcohol consumption, but 8% of adults said yes, and 5% of seniors said yes. Drugs, 6% for each population said yes, that one of those substances had an impact on them or their family. Looking at support systems, which was kind of interesting, we actually listed a whole, maybe 10 or 15 different possible social support systems and asked people to say what percentage of these, how do you basically rank them? And both adults and seniors had high ratings of family as their number one support system. Friends for adults, but church for seniors, and then church third for adults, and doctor for seniors, which we found kind of interesting, that 31% think of their physician as a support system. Caregiving, big thing, especially those individuals who were interested in the 65-plus population were concerned about caregiving, which again plays a part in mental health and psychological well-being. 22% of all respondents are caregivers. Highest among individuals 45 to 54, I guess it's like the sandwich generation. 31% of 65 and 84-year-olds stated that they were caregivers, and 92% received no assistance for caregiving at all, no help as far as another human being, no assistance as far as money. And we know this is a little bit of an issue in our community, and again, they're trying to come up with some strategies to maybe assist those that are caregivers. 35% said that they had some disruption in employment due to caregiving. 62% had to make an adjustment to work life based on caregiving, and 16% said they missed 5 to 10 hours per week of work due to caregiving. So, conclusions. More emphasis needs to be on mental health care within our community, making it available, education on the fact that it is available or needs to be more available, especially for the Latino population. Substance abuse, we still just have our finger on it. We're not sure exactly where that's going. And then support for caregivers is definitely an issue that we're looking at. One thing that is emerging from this 2006, I keep jumping ahead today. I'm always in a rush. Outcomes from the actual 2001 data. Again, I presented the 2006, and it's a little early to look at the outcomes from 2006, the use of it. But from the 2001, nearly a little over $11 million was brought into our community, the city of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County, from using the assessment data to provide services. For example, we have a high teen pregnancy rate. It's 56 per thousand. The state is 23 per thousand. And so one of the initiatives was to develop a teen pregnancy prevention program, and the target population being middle schoolers. I can't talk much about it because that's not my project. But that's just one example. We have a list of them that have come up. The Community Resource Center, from the 2001 data, there was this talk that there's lots of people out there doing great things in our community, but there's just no one place to find out. If you move into the community and you already have a language barrier, where can you go and find out, where am I going to get childcare? Where am I going to find a job? Where am I going to get assistance if I'm 6 months pregnant, and all these different things. And so they developed a Community Resource Center, and it's basically a one-stop shopping for most services that are provided. So you can go to one place or call one place and find out, I need this, this, and this, and they can hopefully guide you in the right direction. Generations Crossing, which is a new program that emerged, again, from the need from the 2001 data, was that there was a daycare center. There was nothing for seniors who did not need assisted living or did not need nursing homes, but basically needed a daycare kind of atmosphere. And so Generation Crossing, and also we had an issue with daycare centers for little kids. And so this program emerges as both individuals in the 65-plus age bracket and little kids, and it's called Generations Crossings. And there's been a lot of research out there. I'm not one to talk on it, but from what I understand from the person who is head of this, that it works for both populations to have this kind of crossing of generations, hence the name. Some of the limitations. Use of landlines, cellular telephones, is a big thing in survey research. There's even been articles talking about the future survey research with people going to cellular telephones. It's too bad that we can't do more survey research via cellular telephone because they're everywhere and everyone's always talking on them. But there's no way to actually get a list of cellular telephone numbers. And so more people are foregoing their landline because it's so expensive and just going to cell phones because they're in and about. So we're a little concerned about that, especially in certain age populations. It tends to be skewed about the individuals who use cell phones. Access to those with low literacy levels, mobility issues, and vision problems. We didn't do a good job in the 2006 of letting people know that when we contacted them that, indeed, we had these services that we could provide to them. They did it a little bit in the 2001. They had nursing students go out that were in a community health nursing course and go to individuals who couldn't read real well or had vision problems and wouldn't be able to complete the survey because it was difficult to read. On longitudinal limitations, again, that's our hope as time goes on. We plan to do this every 5 years, is to be able to look at trends. It's hard to do that because we don't have a lot of the same questions that we asked in 1996 and 2001. And that in and of itself is, you know, we have emerged into looking at, okay, how can we compare data? The presentation I gave this morning, we compared a lot of chronic conditions, preventive services that are sought in the community with Healthy People 2010 goals. And so that was kind of interesting to see, where are we with Healthy People 2010 and chronic diseases? And we are, among adults and seniors, have high levels of cholesterol problems, blood pressure, and diabetes. Among Latinos, they were below Healthy People 2010, which is good, and blood pressure and cholesterol, probably because of the age group, but a little bit high in diabetes. So it does help us, and again, providing services and needs within our community. One good thing that has come out with the 2006 data, again, it's just preliminary, is that we are developing a community health center and are applying for funding, federal funding for it, and it's going to have a mental health component because of what we found with the psychological distress, and that's not common among community health centers in a lot of places. So we are going to have that component where we are going to have a mental health worker present at least some hours of the day. I'd like to thank, this is the subcommittee of the Healthy Community Council Assessment. And if you have any questions, you can visit our website, and there's my Gmail account. And yes?
Yes, I have a question regarding the assessment categories. You mentioned that you got some community feedback in developing those. Can you talk a little bit more about how you specifically chose those categories?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It's been 2 years now. It was a little cumbersome in that we had to we got people and we started looking at other assessments. We actually started doing an Excel sheet and started to look at, okay, what things do we want indicators doing, like infant mortality came up and those kind of, we listed nearly 400 indicators and we started grouping them. What does this group mean? Health, you know, this is economy. And we wanted to look, if you think about all seven of those, they kind of all go to quality of life. When I teach a cross-sectional methodology for my EPI students, I ask them, I said, what things would increase or decrease quality of life within a community? So we looked at that. We just started taking the Excel things, and it was a headache, basically, to start marking things off. And we started asking our questions like, what are you going to use with this data? And how are you going to use it, and how is it going to make changes? Are we going to be able to use this data for grants or for interventions that we may develop within the community? So while we have those seven, and then with those we have the indicators that go with those seven, it was cumbersome process. And we got feedback at the October of 2005 community assessment, and we broke up into groups based on those categories and started giving feedback. And we've modified it. We modified the wording some. So I don't know if that gives you all of it.
I did have a question about when you were doing the role of women and you were asking them what were some of the barriers to about coming. Did anyone talk about domestic violence? Did anyone say, because here in Massachusetts, where I'm from, they screen at three different pharmacies every time I'm doing screen, and they screen up to a year after the baby's born for TB. So I'm just wondering if that's happening there too.
From what I can recall, in the focus groups were about 3 years ago, I can remember one participant in, that talked about domestic violence. The fact that she had left her partner because, you know, there was an issue with domestic violence and he was the father of her child. But I didn't, there were some interventions that took place in the community around domestic violence, and I mentioned the peer health advocacy intervention itself, and this was basically a peer health educator project in which lay health workers were kind of leading these groups within the community health education group, and one of the purposes was to educate them on some, you know, basic things around nutrition and you know, diet, and even things like budgeting, as well as some of the risk factors for infant mortality and prematurity. And domestic violence was a part of that curriculum that they did. But there were some referrals that they made where, you know, as part of the advocacy of their work, when they met with the participants weekly to do the peer health education program, some people did self-disclose that I'm dealing with domestic violence, and there were points in place. One of the members of this intervention, she was the supervisor, she was also a volunteer with the local, you know, domestic violence shelter. So she was really a key, you know, player in terms of making sure that people got the referrals that they need. But in the focus groups themselves, that did not emerge as a major theme. But as part of that intervention, that was something that they did receive training on and help and support and did do referrals for domestic violence as well as other types of social services.
If you're working with policy bases with the SCHIP, I'm not sure you could have overcome the $12 million on the other side, but could you see ways that you could have used that data to inform the public more as well? Is that a realistic kind of a goal?
One thing that was interesting is I did this presentation for the Medicaid Advisory Committee. The governor's health staff person, the human service staff person, attended that meeting. She took the PowerPoint presentation, took it to the governor's office, and he actually ended up using it in his hunger summit.
Okay.
To talk about, you know, it was useful for the legislature because I think the legislature, you know, kind of skipped right over that point. You know, they thought, and they're like, okay, well, we can't quite say going up to 350,000, but 300,000 is okay. I really feel like the issues related to why it didn't pass with the public is due to the tobacco tax and the constitutional amendment. And the people who were supporting the measure only had about $4 million versus $12 million. And so they, you know, just hammered the TVs with these commercials. And, you know, of course, you never have to say, this is paid for by R.J. Reynolds. Even though that was where most of the money came from, they say, this is paid for against Ordonez to give the blank check.
Yes.
You know, and so it sounded very threatening. And they're like, where is this money going to be used? And,
but there's so many examples of that just happening. A lot of the tobacco money has gone on to other programs. And that pissed me off, too. Why did that happen?
Right.
A lot of the other programs that were receiving money from, you know, just around stopping smoking or all tobacco-related.
Right.
In Massachusetts, it's completely gone. All the money goes, all the tobacco goes to other programs.
And this did have a little bit of money to go towards Um,